Welcome to the Pocket Coven podcast, where magic meets mental health. I'm Amber Lenore, a witch and licensed psychotherapist.
I'm Callie Little, a sex educator and emotional support witch, and we're
the coven in your pocket.
Hello and welcome to another episode. We are so excited to have Serena Myers on the podcast today. But before I get into telling you all about who she is, I just want to remind folks that this show would not be possible without our amazing patrons. Amber.
Yeah. Sorry, I was anointing myself with oils. I was distracted.
As one must.
Yes, Callie?
Can you tell the fine folks what they get when they join our Patreon?
They get so much stuff. So they get longer cuts of our episodes. Callie, what's the content we're going to have for today's bonus?
We are going to be speaking with our special guest, Serena Myers, about some Akashic record magic, some ancestral rage magic. And you can't get that here on the podcast. You can only get that on Patreon. But you also get access to our blog posts. You get our bonus podcast, Self as Myth. We have episode one out now. If you haven't heard it, it's all about the myth of Medusa, the hero's journey, and why embracing myth can help you heal.
I'm currently working on the next episode all about Freya, who is really lovely to spend time with. I liked Medusa, but also she was hardcore. So Freya is a breath of fresh air right now.
Yeah, we love the mythology. We love our patrons. And also that's where we're hosting our book club. So if you want to check that out, it is The Pocket Coven. Now that we've got the plug out of the way, let me introduce you to our amazing guest, Serena Myers, who I was fortunate enough to meet a few years ago at an adult summer camp that I was working at, and I got to take an Akashic Records workshop with her, which was so beautiful. It was in a yurt under some evergreen trees, and I got to meet some like old librarians, and there was a magical butterfly. It was so cool. But today she's going to be talking about a different flavor of her magic. So let me tell you a little bit about her. She is a sacred soul mentor, author of the book Sacred Anger, and creator of the Lightwalker's Path podcast. Her divinely guided coaching supports recovering people pleasers dig into how they really feel, including uncomfortable emotions like anger, guilt, and shame. Does that sound familiar to anybody who listens to this podcast? This helps them bring more of what they truly desire into their life so they can align to living with purpose on purpose. Her new book, Sacred Anger, is available now at most major online bookstores. And Amber and I got some copies and gave it a read. And it's lovely. So Serena, welcome. I'm so excited to talk to you about your book.
I'm excited just to hang out with you too. Thanks for inviting me.
So lovely to have you. Amber and I were talking before the call started just about all of the different things you go into. And I know that we both have so many questions. Amber, you had said you had pressing questions.
Vital, potent questions, maybe. Anger as an entity or as an aspect of self is something I'm really, really interested in. When Callie wanted to bring you on the show, it was like, yes, 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 please. And this is a place where I focus a lot of clinical attention because I just noticed that when anger can't be integrated in our self-concept, we really suffer. It really just, It doesn't work actually to just try to shut it off and make it go away. So, I mean, before we get into that, I would really just like to know, like, how did you come to this work? How did you come to sacred anger work?
It started off with a very angry life. I was somebody who, I grew up in not the safest of spaces. I tend to speak a bit euphemistically about it in a lot of ways because it's not just my story. It's like my family's story. And not everybody has given the okay to fully go into it. But let's just say it wasn't the best of times. And safety was a really big thing. I felt very afraid and very unsafe a lot of the time. And I moved out when I was 17, but even then there was this constant pursuit of something stable, something safe. And it was like this never ending pursuit. And it caused me to be really hardened, really angry. I had a chip on my shoulder that I could justify. I could tell you all the crappy things that had happened in my life and why I was entitled to be mad at the world. And it wasn't until, to be honest, my spiritual path kind of snuck up on me in a lot of ways. I went into an ayahuasca ceremony thinking that it was a way to tap into my subconscious, which it was, but it was also a really spiritual experience. And it was in that that time where kind of the crack happened. And once the light started to pour in, I started to recognize that like I wasn't my stories and that something different was possible. And when I kind of got to the root of the anger aspect, I was like, okay, we need to redefine this relationship. And it was not an overnight transition. It took many, many, many years. Like I've now been dancing with anger consciously for like 14 years. And I feel like I've now kind of got a bit more of a hang of it. I still get pissed off, of course. I'm still human. And I do really believe that it's part of the human experience. But my bounce back is so much better. And I'm able to actually get lessons out of it instead of it just becoming who I am and how I'm living day to day.
So, I mean, it really sounds like you've been able to both make space for anger and then also tend to anger in a way that kind of keeps you regulated, like to really build a relational experience with that part of yourself.
I think that's how you're able to tend to it, because when you make the space for it, then you're dealing with it as it comes up as well. And so when you're handling something that makes you angry, you're not handling the 10 things that made you angry before that moment. It's really what's happening in that moment, and then it's getting the gravitas that is like expected and is proportional. Whereas before that, you know, I could get mad about somebody like cutting me off at the crosswalk, and they would hear something that had been like, you know, 2 years worth of chips on my shoulder that I'd been holding on to. And like the crosswalk cutting off where it's like my life at risk, like that's bad enough. But everything was always so big and so disproportionate. And people thought I was a hothead. My old boss used to call me a little ball of rage, which for the people who know me now are like, really? Like, how is that even possible? But well, absolutely. I was an angry girl.
Yeah, I would never have guessed that you had any kind of challenge with anger after, you know, it's not like we've spent a ton of time together, but we've spent really meaningful time together. And if I were to describe you in general, I would say like light and airy in the like easy to be around kind of way, not like airheaded. And very, very grounded, airy and grounded at the same time. So I love that you really have had to forge your way through that. You really know how to lead people through the dark.
Thank you. It kind of gives it purpose. There was a long time where I was just like, oh, woe is me. Why did this happen to me? Why was this my life? And now to be able to take this pain and use it for good and help people feel like they're not alone or that there's nothing wrong with them, it makes me be able to reconcile everything that's happened in my life because I know that it can do some good now.
So I'm curious, do you have a working definition that you like that just is like, what is anger? You know, how do you describe what anger actually is?
I talk about anger as being energy. I talk about emotions as being energy. It's just energy in motion. And so what we define as anger is just a particular frequency of an intensity of an emotion that's moving through us. So it's not who we are. It's something we're experiencing.
I like that. That's very, that feels very normalizing to me.
Mm-hmm. It right? should be.
Yeah. That it's yeah. part of a constellation and all of those things are important. They're all part of you.
And I think it's when we have that little bit of separation of the transientness of our emotions, about how they're moving and that they are not us. When we're in them, particularly with ones that we feel really crappy about, we don't think that we're crappy. We think we're having a crappy time. Something crappy is happening, not that we are the worst people ever. And I think that distinction is really important, particularly when we're at the beginning of our journey with anger, so that as we're redefining our relationship to it, we're able to not beat ourselves up through the whole process because we need a lot of grace. This is a deep, uncomfortable work.
I love that you mentioned that because so often I feel like we all can get into that space where it's like, ah, I'm just being such an asshole to myself. I'm being so mean to myself, when really our difficult emotions, even our self-criticism, it's always coming from an inner place of love and trying to achieve safety. You know, our inner critic is like, no, 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 don't say that, because we have to stay loved. We have to stay safe. And especially for us recovering people pleasers, I know that you identify with that as well, Serena. It's so easy to write it off as like, oh, my brain is being an asshole. But actually your brain is, it's you, and it's trying to love you, and seeing that every single emotion is coming up out of a place of self-love, I find to be really helpful in integrating my emotions.
I think that's beautiful. It's, yeah, viewing it as having like your best interest at heart is really important. And I think also, what can you get from it? Like, we haven't been given these experiences that cause these emotions just for the sake of it. You know, the divine isn't going like, ha ha ha, how can we fuck with them today? Like, that's, you know, that's not what it is. We came here to have human experiences and to extract lessons from them. And I think that when we can do so in a way where we are not shaming ourselves through the process, where we're recognizing like the gifts that are within those things, even the hard things, we get to grow so much in ways that like we wouldn't have had the opportunity to if things were always like sunshine and lollipops.
Oh, Amber and I were talking about that yesterday.
It's, I mean, what's coming up for me right now is just all the moments of struggle I've had with integrating anger. And I am still very much working on this. I had this story that I had sort of banished that, even though I don't even subscribe to the idea of banishing parts of self, I still wanted that one to go away, because my anger is extremely abusive and I can be really fucking mean. And I used to just sort of wear that, like, yeah, I'm a hard bitch and right, fuck you. And so that's still a big part of me that comes out when I'm symptomatic or depressed or anxious. And I'm trying really hard not to be so identified with it. You know, as I become a therapist and I'm like leading other people through a process of you are not your symptoms and seeing them benefit, I'm like, okay, yep, I still need to be doing this. And anger is particularly tricky, because when I hurt people with my anger, they mirror back that that's true, that you are your anger, right? They confirm it. And all of the self-soothing dialogue I know to use, like, oh, it's just trying to protect me, just kind of goes out the window when I've like hurt my daughter with it, for instance. Like that, you know, so holding the tension between those two things, like, yeah, I do hurt people with my anger, and that was an effective strategy when I was an abused kid, right? Just so fucking tricky.
It is, because it, you know, even though we're coming from those hurt parts of ourselves, which are trying to protect, it still has modern today consequences of what's happening. For me, it's so, I had like this one moment. It was so innocuous. I was like 10 or 11 years old. I was walking with my stepdad and I told him that I didn't want him to be my dad. I really wanted him to be my friend, that I had a dad, I liked my dad. And it was just this pure moment. And he was devastated. And it was the beginning of the end of our closeness. I felt him completely cut off. And what I took on was that my words are hurtful, even though there wasn't even anger backing it. There was no malice intended. It was an innocent conversation of me trying to have a healthy boundary at 10 years old and destroying this very sensitive man. And as I became an angrier youth and then an angry young woman and then, you know, an angry, you know, woman in her 30s at that point, I started to really get concerned about what I could do with those words. And because I'm deeply intuitive and empathic, I also know exactly what's going to cut somebody, like as deep as I can possibly go. And I saw it show up in breakups, especially. And when I became a parent, I started noticing that when I'd be mad at my son, I wouldn't make eye contact with him because I was afraid of what my eyes would say and I was afraid what my mouth would say. And I'd freeze him out. And I started realizing like just how alienating that was, because I wasn't giving myself permission to be angry. He wasn't seeing a healthy expression of anger in action. And we weren't actually even talking about what was going on. I was just waiting to like diffuse the situation so that I could actually have the conversation from a calmer place. And there's a place for that. But you know, it doesn't help you rebuild the trust in yourself to not be an asshole, to not destroy the people around you. And then you also don't get to learn how to rebuild when that does happen because it was your natural inclination. So it is, it's not a clear cut journey. It really is kind of like a really awkward dance a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. It really is. You've called it a dance a couple times, and that reminds me that I have a book on my shelf that a therapist told me to read called, I think it's The Dance of Anger. I still haven't read it because this topic is so unapproachable. And I love the way that you're framing it because it makes it so much more approachable, you know, like that anybody could be doing this work in their life.
That's really what I was hoping for. A lot of the women that I work with tend to be really tender-hearted women. They are always in a place of service, whether it's to their families or in their businesses or whatever. They are givers to the max. And that's kind of where some of that people-pleasing tendency comes in. And to sit down and have a conversation about anger is going to be met with a lot of resistance if we just, you know, rip it off and say, all right, here, let's do this. Let's stand naked in front of each other and talk about what's ugly here. And by kind of making it conversational, and even the cover of the book, it's like bright and colorful. It has the energy of anger, but not the like scary intensity of it. I was like, these are the ways that we can have conversation and like normalize it and like make it okay and make it permissible to talk about these things and to experience these things. And then people stop feeling so bad when it would come up. They were just like, hey, I had this thing and this is how I coped with it. Or, hey, I had this thing and I fucked up really bad, but this is how I made it better. And suddenly we started having tools and strategies for being able to work with it. And these are women who are carrying like a lot from this life. But of course, like we have the stuff that we've inherited from our ancestors. We have the stuff that's coming from past lives. So our anger runs very, very deep, very deep. And the willingness to sit down at the table and have a conversation with it is a big ask. And I'm always so impressed and so like proud of the souls who are comfortable enough and courageous enough to have that conversation.
Oh, I love that. Oh God. I love the way you speak about anger. You know, as you were speaking, the thought that came up was, yes, my mother taught me how to be angry. And every time I see myself be angry like my mother, I reject that part because she hurt me with it. You know, the thing that I am hurting other people with hurt me. That's how I learned it, like a language. Yeah.
I resonate with that more than I'm comfortable with. And apologies were not big in our house. The closest thing I got to apologies when I was growing up is my mom would sometimes slip notes under my door because she couldn't actually face me to say, I fucked up, I hurt you, and I'm sorry. And I think there were like maybe 3 notes in my entire life. Like it was not like it was a regular occurrence, but the hurt was regular. And, you know, I think especially as women, it's harder to, when we don't have models of what this looks like in action, it's really hard for us to even know how to be when it's ourselves, especially when everything outside of us is telling us that our anger is not nice, that it makes us, you know, unmarriageable and all the other things that, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, it's not beautiful to be angry. Well, who fucking cares? I'm not here to be beautiful. I'm here to like be an honest expression of myself. So, you know, we get a lot of information telling us what not to do and no one is showing us how to be and still do it honestly.
I feel like everything both of you just said really applies. I mean, in general, but also to my own experience. You know, I grew up also in a very angry household. And the way that I internalized that was that having anger wasn't okay. And it wasn't that like, I have it and it's ugly, so I hate it. It's like, oh, I'm not allowed to have that because that's what abusive people do. So something I've been working on this year is feeling anger. And in its smaller form, like I can always feel angry if somebody, you know, threatens my livelihood, but to be able to feel it a little bit and to feel it when somebody just kind of hurts my feelings a little bit, not to feel big anger, but some like, no, that's not okay. And I'm going to defend myself. I am such a deep rooted people pleaser that in the past, especially, I would go into the like, okay, well, I know that they're probably saying that because they're hurt. I know that, you know, making all the excuses for them and really worrying about forgiving them more than I worry about myself. And something my therapist is having me do all the time is like, okay, center yourself in your life. You need to center yourself. You're the protagonist. And that's been really helpful. But, you know, I wonder, Serena, I know that that's not uncommon. It's not uncommon for people to just shove anger all the way away. But how do you tell people to uncover it? How do you connect with anger as a positive emotion?
I love that you talked about the little ways, how you're comfortable expressing it in those little moments. I think that expressing anger and working with it and being with it and being comfortable with experiencing it is a muscle like any other. So when you can use it in those little ways, it doesn't build up into those big explosive things. When we are expressing our anger, we're in control of it because it isn't the culmination of a whole bunch of unspoken anger that's been pushed down and buried. I have like a lot of issues with my dad as well. And I used to be the person who would bury down. I would literally be crying in front of him and he would say, "What's wrong?" And I'd say, "Nothing." And he'd say, "But you're crying." And I'd say, no. I'm just, my eyes are just dry. My eyes are just watering. I'd make up excuses for what was very clearly upset. And I couldn't even just speak up about it. And last week, when we had the book launch, I had invited him and he didn't come. And I was pissed. And it took me 2 days to calm down enough to be like, "That wasn't very cool." But when we had the conversation, because I waited 2 days and not 2 years of things where I could pull out my laundry list of everything he had done wrong in that time, I was able to be really calm. And every time he'd make an excuse, I would counter the excuse like really calmly. But I'd be like, "Well, what about this?" And he'd go, "Well, yeah, but what about that?" And I'd say, "Okay, great. But then what about this?" And every time he would have a new thing, I think he had like three different excuses and I cut him off every single time. And then he took a breath and he went, "You know what? I'm sorry. I'm sorry I hurt your feelings." And I was like, "Thanks." And that's all I needed to hear. Then it was fine. It was over. But I needed to actually say it for myself instead of being that 9-year-old girl who would cry and blatantly lie about her tears right in front of him because she wasn't comfortable and safe to do that. But this is because of the work that I've been doing of speaking up as it's happening instead of burying it down. And then you have those little wins, and those little wins make you stronger. And then you start to know how to do it. And when the stakes are low, that's a great time to practice. And then when the stakes are higher, it's easier to do. You're not like trying to then climb Everest. You've already climbed like all these other little mountains before that. And you're like, "Okay, I can do this big one because I have this experience and I know how." It's like muscle memory at that point.
You have become such a wonderful parent to yourself.
I had to be, but thank you for saying that. Yeah, it was, I started working with my inner child, I want to say about 2008, 2009. And it was really working with my 5-year-old self. She's the one who kind of carried the biggest hurts. And then whenever I tap into her, she changes ages depending on what's going on in my life. And currently I'm working with my angry, rebellious teenager. She's about like 15, 16. That's what we're working with now. But being able to speak up for her and being able to give her voice and honor her and like she asks me to do like the stupidest things, but I do it. The biggest request was that every time I'm in a pool, I need to do a mermaid handstand. So I do, I made it up when I was like 8. But basically, you go in the pool, you put your legs up in a handstand, and you put your feet together, and you like flap your feet as though they're your fin. Every single time. And I look around, and you know, like pools are not exactly empty. And I'm like, "Okay, it's going to be super self-conscious, but we're going to do this." Because in those little honorings, it's the same thing. It's another muscle. It's building up trust. And it's letting her know that I'm safe. So we're able to do this work together. It's been really, really transformative.
God damn it. I didn't realize something until you just started talking about it. That's what happens when we record. We're like in process together. But when you said, "I am currently working with my angry, rebellious teen," my most recent argument with my 17-year-old daughter came up and I saw myself acting like a teenager. And it hadn't occurred to me that there is a part of me that is a teenager and was overly parentified and resents that she didn't get to go to the mall or like just have normative experiences. And as my daughter is expanding, there's a sense that like she's taking too much from me. She's taking too much space. Like, go do it yourself. Leave me alone. And wow. Yeah, seeing which part was coming up is such a gift. So thank you so much for doing your work, because then that helps me do mine, and then someone else will hear this and that helps their work.
Perfect. It's the circle of helping.
Yeah. There is a poem by Andrea Gibson, and there's a line in it that says, "You can sound the music in others simply by playing your own strings."
Ooh. Oh, I love that.
a long, satisfied groan.
I love the harmony that you both had with that. Oh, the resonance, right? I mean, this is, you know, we were talking about, I think it was in our last episode that we were talking about hugging trees, right? And we were talking about the, what is it, Amber?
Mirror neurons.
Yes. Yeah. I really feel that sensation even when it's just over video like we're doing right now. I feel like just spending time with another's consciousness, even if we're not in each other's presence, I feel like it really happens. And I know that that's part of the magic that people hear in these episodes, where they get to witness parallel process.
I think so too. I think there's a lot of people I know are doing this kind of work in their own little silo, either because the people around them aren't supportive of this work or they're worried about the disruption of the status quo, even though that's what's going to happen when they fully live and embody the things that they're doing for themselves anyway. And I think that we can only get so far on our own. Mm-hmm. Even if it is like exposing ourselves to TED Talks and books and whatever, we need other people's experiences. We need to see a world outside of our own, because it makes the scope of what's possible so much wider. Even when you're somebody who has like a pretty open mind, it can go even bigger when you have new perspective to help expand it. So I really, my heart almost breaks for people who do this work in a silo, because I think we can get so much further when we do it together.
God, especially with anger, because of this, the stigma attached to anger. It's so real. And watching people live with that, their internalized stigmatization of their own anger, you're not allowed to be here, fuck off, right? It just hurts them so much. So, I mean, yeah, just thank you for doing that. Thank you for being you so other people can be them too.
Thank you. It's kind of pulled me out of, how do I say this? I really had the fear of being found out for my whole life, like of these different aspects. When I was a kid, there were a lot of things that were like questionable in nature that was happening in our family and in our house. And there was always this need of like, we have to keep the secret. No one can find out. That was always like the big thing. And there was that fear. And when I went to high school, we actually moved neighborhoods and I had this chance of a fresh start. And I thought, okay, great. Like no one's going to know. But there was always this fear that someone was going to find out. When I moved away, I moved across the country. Like I really like moved out like all the way to BC from Ontario in Canada, because I was really just trying to have this space that was entirely mine. But you don't really leave your past behind, because as long as you're still waiting to be found out, someone can still tell that secret for you. And before I wrote this book, I used to think that I had to wait till my family was dead before I could ever tell any of our stories, because I still had that fear. And what I realized is that when I could just out myself for having these feelings and for having these experiences, when I could just be really transparent, I got to be the one who told the tale. I was in control of the narrative. And then I didn't have to wait for anyone else to out me. It outed myself. And anger was a big part of that, because people, especially when I started to have conversations around about my mental health and about self-care, everyone was like, oh yeah, you know, she's that Zen girl. Oh, she's really spiritual. She's really whatever. Like think of the words that Callie used at the start to describe me. Like people would not have expected this. And so when we have those expectations of what people are and those assumptions, then when we don't see ourselves in them, when we have those dark moments ourselves, we start to think that there's something wrong with us. Whereas when we can start to be more open and transparent about these feelings, when we're not busy trying to hide them away or worry that someone's going to find out, then we normalize it all. And it's safe to just be human.
Oh, my goodness. You just gave me this beautiful thought, Serena, which is, you know, part of my work that I do in my life. I have devoted myself to unconditional universal love, and it is work. But one of the ways that I do that is I always look for the best in people. And I just now in this moment realized that it's still an assumption. By looking for the best in people, instead of just looking at the person in front of me, I am erasing truth because I can't know. And even when it's something like, oh, Serena is this really grounded person, that story that I'm telling about my experience of you, it actually takes away a lot of your humanity.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, your intentions are good.
Right. Well, the intentions are to be kind, but kindness isn't inherently good. Kindness can be self-serving. You know, it's like, oh, I'm a really kind person. I speak about people kindly. I say nice things about people. Yeah, but like, do you see the people that you're talking about? Or are you just saying, oh, bless their heart? You know, I grew up in a Southern family and, oh, she's just a trollop, but bless her heart. She tries, you know. My Southern grandmother would never have said that, but.
Callie. I mean, and also, you know, Callie, as you're reflecting this to Serena, the thought that's coming up for me is like, and please don't assign me some level of perfection. Like, oh, you know, these podcasters and this guest are so insightful. Oh, that's for them. That's not for me. Like, don't take away my years of hard work. And also don't do that to yourself. Like, don't tell yourself that the people around you that you're perceiving that you think have some level of emotional intelligence or integration that you don't have just come by it without any kind of work.
Snap, snap, snap. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And I mean, if you think about self-love, like you were talking about, Callie, self-love isn't just like, these are my good days. These are my good traits. This is seeing the good, the bad, the ugly, and loving all of yourself anyway.
Yes.
And so when we're talking about like looking at the best in people, we want to actually look at people, like you said, and say, hey, I can see the good, the bad, and I love them anyway, or accept them anyway. And I notice this when people die, we start to forget about the shitty things and we just start to like elevate them to saint status. And it's like, yeah, but also, and also, you know, these other things. And it's okay. And it's not about like speaking ill of the dead. It's okay to love a flawed human, whether they're alive or dead, right? I mean, that's what we are. And pretending otherwise is, I think that's the hardness that we talk about. That's why people feel the need to curate their social media feeds and only show perfection, because that's what they want other people to see.
I find it to be ineffective. Like, I'm really concerned with what is effective and what works, less about good and bad, because good and bad are not actually helpful concepts. I find they're rooted in moralism or moral perspective. Who's to say what's good and bad? What informs what's good and bad? But a lot of, I think, at least for me, what you're speaking to is a like the cultivating of an observing self, the one who just sees. Right? Working with observing ego has been so helpful in my work with others, because I noticed I was doing this thing with my clients where I was really wanting them to get to this place of self-love, because I've experienced it and I know how great it is and I want to get them over there. But when they're immersed in self-hatred, it's like too much of a hard shift. Like they need to come to a place where they can just observe what they're doing free of shame in any kind of way before they actually feel loving or positive, or they feel more light, as it were, right? They have to just be able to see what's going on.
It's almost like acceptance is the middle ground. Mm-hmm. So it's like self-loathing, self-acceptance, and then self-love. And we need to have like that kind of pit stop in the middle. The thing that I always say with my therapist as I start recognizing, like, when I have these epiphanies about like shitty things about either myself or how I've engaged or whatever, rather than going to this place of like, oh my God, I'm the worst, which is what I used to do, I go, huh, isn't that curious? And it's this weird little quirk that I've picked up. But by going from that place of a little bit of detached curiosity, I'm able to see it and then go like, why did I do that? Or why did I feel like that? And then I can pick it apart in a way and actually like extract what was going on there. But I do it without going down the shame spiral first. And that was an impossibility even like probably 5 years ago.
I love that. I love that. I really like that level of transparency when I'm working with people. Like, huh, wow, I'm feeling kind of anxious. That's interesting. I'm just going to take a second. I'm going to ground. Huh. I think I might be resonating with what you're talking about. You know, and I like that also, that modeling, like, hey, hi, you can slow down and observe yourself and name that you're doing that. There's nothing wrong with that. And like you were saying before, it's a muscle that's being developed. I love the muscle metaphor for self-work. It's again, it's just like a neutral position. right? A muscle is not weak because it's bad. It's weak because it hasn't been flexed or it hasn't been utilized a lot. And,
yes.
And as a muscle is breaking apart, that hurts, right? That's uncomfortable. And then as it's being knit back together with love and support, it's growing stronger.
Again, I mean, another callback to our episode on the season, you know, on Ostara. We talked about how as you are emerging in your new self and every part of yourself that you're learning, every new piece of acceptance you get, that part of you is really just freshly born. And babies can't hold their head up, you know. they need time to develop muscles, and we really have to be very kind to our beginner selves. You know, there's a reason that the Fool is the first card of the tarot. It's because all of us are always the Fool going through the journey. And even when mm-hmm. we master something, it's still every single day is our first time going through that day. Every emotion is our first time going through that exact cocktail of chemicals in our body. We're always beginning. So why try to be a master every moment of the day?
I think you have just created the remedy for the trap I used to catch myself in, which was, oh, but I've been doing this for so long. I should be over it by now, or I should know better. But if we can have those fresh eyes, right, where we can say, I give myself permission to be the Fool, then there isn't this expectation of, like, you know, perfection from ourselves just because we've been doing it for a long time.
I tell people that, like, so when you first start working on your mental health or yourself in general, you're kind of like approaching this pond of who you are, and you can see a bunch of stuff floating around. You can see that there's like a tire in there. There's a boot. There's a lot of garbage. It's green. You can't see through the water. So you start taking care of the stuff on top. You get the tires out. You get the boots out. You get the garbage. And then it's like, okay, well, you still can't see to the bottom. So then you have to work on the water quality. And then once you can do that, you can see the stuff at the bottom. And once you can see the stuff at the bottom, you can uncover all of the monsters hidden under there. So you're more and more and more prepared, and more stuff is always going to happen. And when I get into that spiral with my therapist where I'm like, okay, but life is constant suffering, and I'm tired and I don't want to work on this anymore, they're like, right. And you've felt that way before. And what did your past self do? Got through it and is now more well-adjusted, more capable. You have more tools at your disposal. So even though it is still hard, it's a little bit easier. And I have to begrudgingly agree.
And thank God, right? Yeah. Like, thank God that you have those skills and that that has strengthened over time. I love your lake metaphor. I always think about it as layers. Mm-hmm. And I think the lake actually has a lot more tending to, which I think is actually more relevant and indicative of the process that we go through. I had in a therapy session last November or December, I had a question answered that I sat down in my very first ceremony in November of 2008.
Wow.
And I finally got the answer. And I was so mad that it took that long. And when I sat down with my guides and I was like, you guys, like, I have shown up for you. I have meditated. I've done these ceremonies. I've done this work. I have worked on my Akashic records. I worked with my angels. What the fuck? Like, why were you holding out on this for like 12 years? And they were like, you weren't ready. So they had been peeling off layers and showing me a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And then they blew my entire mind last year. And as resentful as I was for how long that took, I'd cultivated a lot of skills in 12 years. And if they had told me that in moment one, it probably would have shattered my psyche. So, but when we tend to the, if I could have had that idea of tending to the lake rather than it being like, you know, them holding out on me, I think that probably would help me reframe that experience a whole lot better.
Also, as you were talking, I was kind of seeing you build a bridge that I want to kind of take us over, which is, what does it look like when a spiritual person, when a witch is working with her anger? You know, like, this podcast is mental health and witchcraft and magic. So can you speak a little bit to anger work as a witch?
So I think it really depends on your readiness and your willingness, because how you engage with anger is going to vary drastically depending on how comfortable you are with it. The first things that I started doing, and I didn't even consciously do this about anger initially, it was at the time of breakups, and I would host fire ceremonies. And I wasn't someone who had a coven. I wasn't someone who was like really taught. I just followed instinct. And I wouldn't have even, I think at that time I really identified as a witch, but that I've really danced with that word over like the last, I think since I was about 15, so 25 years, I've danced with that word. But I would sit down and I worked with the destructive power of fire. Fire was so huge for me for a really long time. And it was because it was primal and visceral, and it didn't have to be like really dangerous. It just had to be destructive. And so what I would do is I would sit down like under the moon, under a tree in some dirt, and I'd have a little bowl and I'd have just some matches and pieces of paper. And I would write down on these pieces of paper the things that I wanted to release, that I wanted to let go of. And then I would take them one by one and I would really like just like embed my energy into them and really like be with them one by one. And I'd set it on fire and I'd watch it burn. And then as I started to do more conscious anger work, fire stopped being my main tool. I think because like I am quite fiery as a person, I was leaning a bit too much in that area and I needed an actual gentle approach. And I started working with water for transmuting anger instead. So I do shower ceremonies almost every day where it's a meditation where I sit down and it's, I get my downloads in there. I also release in the water. I feel it when it hits me in the top of the head and I imagine it kind of cascading and just shifting anything consciously or unconsciously that I'm holding onto, and then I watch it go down the drain. And there, you know, I know a lot of people's ceremonial practice is you're not actually watching it. Like if you're doing like a despacho, you would like give it to the fire and then you don't watch it. Where I feel like there's something really important in that relationship with the element of saying like, you're doing the work for me. Like I've shown up for you, but you're doing this work for me and thank you. And so I really honor that process of the element moving things through me. So fire and water are kind of my two go-tos. For other people, you know, they might do something with like automatic writing, which I started a process last year called automatic writing. So that it's like a doodle process, so that you're asking the questions, but then when you're doodling out the answers, you're not actually, because you're in that creative mode, your conscious mind is busy with the doodle and your unconscious mind is able to speak through it. So we start to access new layers of ourself, and you can use it to even speak with your angels or your guides or whoever it is that you work with. I work with crystals a lot too. I do a lot of work with black tourmaline. I have a piece that's probably, I don't know, what would this be like? I'm like holding it up with my hands. I can't think of what that would be the size of, but it's a very large piece of black tourmaline. And I've been using that since I worked in neurofeedback. I worked in a clinic where we weren't allowed to do anything wooey or spiritual to manage the energy. And people were releasing all day, every day in that chair. So I would slip this massive piece of black tourmaline in the room every time I would clean up between clients as a way to just kind of soak up some of what had been let go. So everyone's going to have their kind of own relationship with release and also their own readiness for release. Sometimes there's still things that we need to learn from the anger. Sometimes we aren't ready to let go. When we bring in the element of forgiveness, sometimes we're not ready to forgive because we think that if we forgive, we're saying that what they did was okay. And that is not what forgiveness is at all. But so long as we hold on to those truths, it's hard to say, because then we're almost like invalidating our own hurt. And that's not the purpose at all. So we kind of have to find our own comfort with like what, how we want to engage with the anger, and then how we want to extract the lessons, and then how we want to let it go. And for some people, it's like a naked dance party, honestly, like it's so personal. And even though I have all these tools at my disposal, what I do depends on where I'm at that given day. Cause some days I'm a lot more comfortable to sit down and talk to my anger than others. So
I love that. I love how you're using elemental witchcraft and visualization and just all of these wonderful tools of the witch. These are the tools of the witch, is the ability to connect with literally the elements and then also their symbols and let them work for us. Like, what a great way to surrender to and practice surrendering and working with an element. Wonderful.
And it's the trust in it too of like, I'm giving this to you and I know that it's taken care of. And I'm quite type A. So that's already like a really big leap. And when it's humans, I actually have a lot harder time. When I'm working with different aspects of the divine, it's a lot easier for me to say, I give this over to you and I'm going to trust that it's all right. Like the book launch was bananas. The publisher was like, things weren't getting distributed and like Amazon was holding back books and stuff that I had sent out to influencers wasn't getting there. And my type A self was like, ah. And then I was like, you know what, Serena, you can't control this. Like you can get as angry as you want. Nothing's going to happen. And I sat down with my angels because I tend to work with angels more than anything. And I was like, guys, I'm giving you this launch. I'm going to trust that the books end up in the right hands at the right time. And I surrender it to you. And every time I would catch myself with like my blood pressure rising when I would look at a tracking number and something wouldn't go out, I'd be like, you handed this over. Shoo. And it would all come right back down again. And it's that trust element that is so huge. And again, another muscle that we have to practice on strengthening.
Yes.
Pointing no fingers.
I have been having some difficulty with the impermanence of, you know, the juicy, yummy emotions. And I was in a flow state for like a few weeks and then I got distracted and I fell out of it. And I've been annoyed with myself for not being back in it. But like, I have done magic around it. So I have to trust that that magic is working. And that's a really good reminder. And damn, Serena, you're talking. And I'm just like, ooh, when we make the Pocket Coven Mystery Camp happen, because you know it's going to happen, you have to be a teacher there.
I would love that.
I have.
Absolutely.
I've taken your workshop. I love the way you teach. I love the way that you lead by example. I love how much permission you provide by your example for others. I think that you're really honest with yourself in a way that is very important to me when I'm looking at other people who do this kind of work, where you're not like, oh, I am enlightened and this has come to me. It has been bestowed unto me.
I have fucking ascended.
Right. Like you have to work so hard. You have to go through the fucking mud to get the lessons. And I love that you embrace that.
Thank you. Well, one of the conversations I've been having with my guides lately is I love my resilience. I love that I can like carve through these shitty things and take something beautiful from it. But I'm also ready for it not to be so hard.
Uh-huh.
Because I know that the energy that I expend in just like surviving crappy things could be better used at teaching other people how to survive crappy things. So that's what I'm currently working on in terms of shaping my current reality is to be able to take that and say like, hey, it's awesome that this is how we've done it. I've been forged in fire. Now could we make it a little gentler so I could use that energy on some other stuff?
I like that you said forged in fire. That works with a metaphor I like for anger, which is that it's armor, that it's protecting something that is very vulnerable. And how sweet of it to try to do that. That's so wonderful. And also armor is really heavy and there needs to be enough safety and containment to take off the armor and not wear it for a while, you know, like,
yeah.
Again, like I love my resilience too. Like, thank you. Thank you so much. And also, a lot of the things you learned actually don't work anymore because we're so safe now. I know, mm-hmm. It's weird. We're safe. You can go ahead and take off that shield. That's really a lot to be carrying, girl.
Well, that's the thing with the shield. Like, it's protective, but it's also keeping the good stuff out too. So we're always experiencing these beautiful moments kind of muted. Mm-hmm. And so there is a beautiful liberation and a freeing, and it doesn't feel like that at first because as soon as we take that armor off, we feel exposed and it's scary as hell. But once we can get used to that kind of being our new normal, and once we can cultivate spaces and people and relationships that are safe enough where we can just be exposed, and maybe we've got that shield at the ready, but we can walk around unarmed so that we can have experiences to their entirety. And then when someone enters the space and like maybe wasn't so trustworthy, then the shield can come back up, but that's not our default setting anymore.
Yes, yes, yes. See, coming at it from my tenderhearted place, it's like one little emotional arrow has hit me in the past and I'm bleeding to death. Like, it doesn't yeah. work to not have anger, because it is a boundary. It's a boundary between you and things that can hurt you. So, I mean, it's also information. When you're getting angry, it's because a sensor is going off. And yes, it can have been misprogrammed by abusive situations, but also it can be the alarm system it's meant to be. It can be that chest plate, you know, or the chainmail, whatever works for you, you know. But I went through so much of my adult life with no armor, and coming from an abusive situation and just going through life being like, I guess I'm learning every single step of the way, unlearning how to be an abusive person, because that's what you learn in abusive situations, and finding my way, falling in love, getting jobs. You're gonna get hit with shit. So you do have to have these skills. It is a beautiful, necessary emotion. There's a reason we have it. There's just a more productive way to have it than many of us do.
Yes, and I want to yes and this whole fucking episode, like, for yeah. the next 2 hours. just to be really honest, it's such a cool vibe right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Callie, as you were talking and as I'm reflecting in this conversation, I'm noticing that by doing this work with anger, because Callie and I are definitely working with that shadow work, and mm-hmm. I am so angry, and I carve away all of that anger, and as I reclaim it and integrate it, my magic is so amplified. It is yes. crazy. Like, my witchcraft is so powerful, so potent. I'm able to affect so much change because I'm transmuting all of that energy into something else. I'm not invalidating it. I'm not telling it to go away. I'm asking it to work with me.
Yeah, I think there's two really cool things that happen when we do anger work as witches. The first is that when we are doing any of that release component, now we have space. So when everyone's busy trying to call in and manifest and whatever, but they haven't done the work of actually clearing out room for that stuff to come in, they're never going to get very far. Whereas when we do that work where we've made space to welcome in what we actually want in our lives, boom, now it's possible because we've let those things go that had served their purpose and they just don't need to take up space with us anymore. And the second part, when we talk about dropping that shield, when we want to have divine experiences, whether it's like talking to our ancestors or angels or whoever, there is an element of needing to be willing to be seen. And so long as we have that guard up, we can only be seen so far. So when the guard is down, it's almost like things are a little bit more permeable, and therefore our magic is a lot more potent. It's having to work through a lot less resistance to get out into the world and likewise come back. So yeah, it is, if for no other reason than to be more potent as a spiritual being, that is the reason to dig into your anger.
If I could snap, I would, but I can't.
I'll do it for you.
Just listen, it's a chubby noise. Look how ineffective that snap is.
I'm so pumped from this conversation. Like, you know, we always know that it's going to be a good time recording an episode, but this is, you got right in the flow with us, Serena. You are a fucking gem. And yes. I feel like this is a good moment for us to maybe get into the special Patreon content where we're going to talk to you about ancestral rage. But before we do that, we're going to give our listeners to the podcast, you know, proper here on all of the platforms, a couple more pieces of information. So if there are any final thoughts that you have on the subject, I would love to hear those. And also, we want people to be able to find you. So final thoughts, and where can people get your magic?
So final thoughts would be like just let it be weird and let it be uncomfortable and give yourself permission for that, to feel it all, for it to be a bit messy and to not worry about how good it looks, because it's not supposed to look good. Just honor the feelings, make space for it. If it means, like, you know, taking a day to just be with it and be miserable for a bit, then that's okay. It's entirely part of the process. And in fact, you're going to move it a whole lot faster by allowing yourself to feel it than you are by pushing it down, pretending it's not happening, and then have it blow up in your face when it's going to surprise you at a very inopportune time. I guarantee it. And in terms of where to find me, my website is serina.ca, S-E-R-Y-N-A.ca, and the book is sacredangerbook.com. So if you are looking for a copy and you'd like to find it somewhere other than Amazon, for instance, there are some suggestions there.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been such a beautiful conversation, and I can't wait to talk to you more about all of these things. And I don't know if you saw, but we are currently doing a special collaboration with Rosy Cheeks, etc. They have made a whole series of pocket coven face masks that are super comfy. They're made of small business made material. We support a lot of different artists by doing it. And our listeners get $3 off with code PocketCoven. You can get the link to Rosy Cheeks shop in the show notes. And every time you buy a mask from them, it supports them, the artists we buy fabric from, and also the podcast itself. And while we did sell out of almost every single one, there are only 3 masks left in the shop, we have a restock with all new fabrics coming in other than our one returning fabric, which was the most popular and sold out in a matter of a couple hours.
And as always, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. We got a new review that I sent to Callie at, I don't know, some really ridiculously early hour. And she was up and I was like, oh, there's my girl getting up early. I love that for her. All right. So here's the new review. This is by Oli Hope. The title is Magic Friends in Your Pocket, which is exactly the goal. Yay. They say, in a sometimes dark world, what a gift to find a bit of light. Where magic meets mental health feels empowering as an act of protest when the latter has been historically and systemically sequestered by the former. What a beautiful phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. Amber and Callie's authenticity is both comforting and inspiring. It is easy to listen to their soothing voices for hours. Ow. I appreciate their generosity in sharing their expansive knowledge and genuine experience.
We appreciate you.
Thank you, Oli Hope. We appreciate you so much. And next week we're going to be recording something on location during our Ostara nature immersion is what I'm deciding we're calling these trips that we keep taking.
It's true. We're going to take a multi-mile hike with lots of ankle protection to Nodule Point, I think. It's going to be cool.
A location that you can't find unless it's low tide and you walk to it. It's very secluded and a friend told me about it. Thank you, Abby. And so listen for that. It should be pretty magical and expansive.
Join us on Patreon for more of Serina Myers, and also join us for our book club starting this week. I was really excited. This was actually the very first sponsor that you and I reached out to because we really wanted to build relationships with actual therapeutic tools into the podcast.
One of the biggest struggles I have as a therapist is just wrestling with the inaccessibility of mental health treatment. So because BetterHelp can do therapy from their home and do it remotely, that means that people, you know, they don't have to go anywhere, which can actually be a thing. Like if you don't have a car or access, getting to a clinic can actually be difficult. Mm-hmm. So just the convenience of being able to be at home, I think, is really important. And then that increases the possibility that people will actually utilize therapy.
Yeah, I know that it has felt like a significantly lessened burden for me to be able to do therapy from home just on my phone. And I really hope that the world just gets more comfortable with virtual therapy in general because of where we're at in the world.
I agree. And I think it's important that mental health consumers have the ability to have a say in who their provider is. As a therapist, I definitely, you know, I meet a new client and I'm like, well, you know, I don't think we're a good fit. So can I help you find someone who is? Or they tell me I'm not a good fit and that's fine. I think we really need to normalize that. And with BetterHelp, you can change anytime and choose a different provider if they're not a good fit for you. Because likely, you know, you might need to try on, you know, a few different kinds of providers before you find the one that's right for you.
Having therapists who are capable of helping me with my specific needs and
to say that they offer that worldwide is really cool to me. Mm-hmm. Really like that BetterHelp has financial aid available for people. This is a long-term therapeutic process, so this isn't a crisis line. It's different than that. It is not a self-help line. It's different than that. So it's a therapeutic relationship that needs to build consistently. So that's what you can get. And because BetterHelp is partnering with us, you can go to betterhelp.com/pocketcoven and you can actually get 10% off of your first month. If within that time you decide you don't like your therapist, you can, as Amber said, just easily switch to a different one. It's super accessible and it's betterhelp.com/pocketcoven. That will get you 10% off. It'll get us just a little bit of a kickback. So it's a great way to support the podcast and your well-being at the same time.